Hello and welcome to the programme. Today, great news about the humpback whale, whose numbers are growing after decades in decline. We meet the Irishman, who took part in a 230-kilometre ultra event in Kenya in support of wildlife rangers. And we ask, just what is it about the Kerry slug that makes it so special?
The spots of the giveaway, yeah. So if you find a large slug that's sort of gingery hazel brown in colour, covered in yellow and white spots, it's definitely a Kerry slug. If you find a jet black slug that's covered in white spots, it's also definitely a Kerry slug as well.
If you put it in a matchbox and look away and look back in it and it's gone out of it, it's definitely a Kerry slug.
Yeah.
So a busy show ahead of us today, and a busy studio. Richard Collins and Aine Nilana are with me today, as is Mark Ruddock, Red Kite Project Manager for the Golden Eagle Trust. And that's where we start our programme. Mark is also joined by his father, Dougie Ruddock, who I met recently. Hello, Dougie. How are you today?
Good morning, Derek.
You're going to tell us a fascinating story. At least if it isn't going to be fascinating, make it up. As I always say to people, if you can't make it interesting, make it up. Right. And Mark, good to see you again.
Good to see you, Derek.
Now, Mark, the Red Kites, tell us more. Take us back to the beginning for the benefit of people who are hearing this story for the first time. The Red Kite in Ireland.
Absolutely. The Red Kite in Ireland is, well, as we stand now, is a conservation success story, a species that was extinct in Ireland and brought back through a partnership between the Golden Eagle Trust, National Parks and Wildlife Service, and the Welsh Kite Trust. And we brought over 160 red kites from Wales, and those were reintroduced to County Wicklow and North County Dublin. And we now have a very successful red kite breeding population in Wicklow and over into Wexford now as well, and in North Dublin and Meath we have a population of over 80 pairs of kites now. And on an all-Ireland basis, the reintroduction that happened in Northern Ireland, we're well over 100 pairs of kites on the island of Ireland now.
That's fantastic. So they didn't suffer the fate of some of the other birds of prey that were brought in. Did they suffer from poisoning? Were they shot? Were there any kind of other awful tragedies they met?
Unfortunately, we have some ongoing issues with poisoning and occasionally shooting, but generally people in Wicklow and across the country have welcomed these birds. But unfortunately, we still do lose a couple. As a specialist scavenger, of course, they're very vulnerable to things that are laced with poison, or indirectly through things like rodenticides as well. If they're scavenging or eating dead or dying rats, they can become victims themselves.
So that's secondary poisoning. That's not deliberate. But have there been deliberate attempts to kill them?
We have certainly come across, there are chemicals, things like carbofuran and alpha-chlorolose. Carbofuran in particular has been banned in the EU since 2001. And that's just something that shouldn't be out there and shouldn't be getting.
So you think that's been left out there deliberately?
It has to be.
So you're talking about a prey item that's been laced with this stuff and then the bird comes down and takes it?
Typically the things that would be found very often, carbofuran, species that are killed by it, don't go very far from their last meal. This stuff is incredibly toxic and very often they're found dead right next to the bait that perhaps they've been eating. Whether those baits are left out for other species, which of course is now illegal, things like foxes. Once upon a time, people may have done that, but that of course now is illegal, leaving meat baits out with any poisons. But as I said, the specialist nature of a scavenger like the red kite and also like the buzzard, they're the first to find these things. They're the vultures of the Irish countryside, and they're very quick to get exposed.
Before we let Aine and Richard in, I suppose we should at this point, for again the benefit of the listeners and for myself, to remind me, what does a red kite look like? What is it?
Well, the name gives it away. There's a reddy colour at least. fascinating birds, and of course the most distinctive. They're reasonably large, about a 4 to 5 foot wingspan. Very, very graceful in the air. Fantastic flying species. And the most distinctive thing to look for, of course, is the forked tail. They have a very distinctive forked tail. Of talking to people over the last couple of days, even just how confiding kites can sometimes be, literally hovering and flying right over the tops of people, tend to be quite confiding compared to things like buzzards or sparrowhawks, which people get either further away or
if you look at an office building and you see a decoy on top of the office building, which is tethered by a wire or a rope, the way it moves around in the wind is often what I think of when I see a red kite.
Absolutely. And then of course over the summer we had a chance to see so many of them and work alongside yourself with those as well. And they are just so graceful, and this time of the year, coming into this season, is the best time, I think, in Ireland for kites. Coming into the winter, we've got these big aggregations coming in through the villages and towns, particularly in Wicklow and Avoca Village at this time of the year, all the way through to Christmas and early January. The roost site with over 100 birds circling and gliding and floating around the village is just a
spectacle. And the call they make is lovely, isn't it?
That whistling sound call, yeah. Is just absolutely
spectacular. There used to be a common species in our towns before they became extinct. I mean, the kite, it was called the kite because they actually collect clothes and bits of rags and socks and goodness knows what to put into their nests. They're not at all considered to be a bird of towns any longer. So in spite of us all thinking the world is getting worse, I mean, they were able to live in towns because of the filth in the towns, because of the amount of rubbish and sewage and everything else that was there then. So is this an improvement or a disimprovement?
Well, I think gradually as the population expands in Ireland, we're actually seeing them coming closer and closer in towards people and very close in and around farms. We've now got nests in people's back gardens. And we do see that the ancient name, the cloth kite, that we've got them actually now collecting rags and bits of toys and footballs and all sorts of unusual items adorning some of the nest sites with. And we do, there's some people in Wicklow that literally look out their kitchen window and they've got a kite nest in the back garden, which must be a pretty incredible scene to see.
Because they nest in trees, obviously, so if you have a good, decent tree, another reason for having a tree in your garden.
Absolutely, and that was one of the reasons why we selected Wicklow as the reintroduction site, the most heavily wooded county in Ireland. Trees are fundamentally important. We do find them in some of the larger native woodlands. They do use conifer plantations, the edges of them occasionally, but typically we've actually got them in small copses, hedgerow trees. You'd be amazed at how a small ash tree in a hedgerow that's just allowed to get away turns into a lovely specimen of a tree, and we've got a number of kite nests now nesting in those.
It is a pity about the rodenticides I mean at least the new regulations that have come in now that have banned permanent baiting except by trained professionals in a particular situation. Permanent baiting is otherwise banned. This is bound to have an impact on the availability of poisons left out all the year round, and must hopefully, I mean, this only came in this year, this permanent baiting ban, and it'll have an impact surely on the amount of poisons that are in the wild there to be picked up by birds of prey, would you think?
Absolutely. I think anything, you know, rodenticides are a necessary tool for work that people need to do. But I think the key message of the campaign for responsible rodenticide use, obviously, is think wildlife. There is something at the other end of the chain that potentially may become exposed to that. And kites and buzzards and barn owls and a number of species in Ireland still do face that challenge. So anything that makes an improvement or reduces the risk of accidental exposures is obviously going to be of benefit to this species.
Mark, a mad idea comes into my mind when I see that wonderful profile you describe with the big forked tail. Now, the nearest thing to it that I've ever seen is the frigate bird. Further south, the seabird that doesn't actually land on the sea. Now, they say that this thing prefers the air so much that it actually sleeps up there. Now, surely the kite must be tempted to sleep on the wing or spend an awful lot of time on the wing. How much of its life is spent up there? Is the ground something it has to visit reluctantly to breed and to feed?
Certainly whenever we watch them, they just look like they enjoy flying is the way I could perhaps best describe it. They look like they derive great pleasure from it. Perhaps that's me anthropomorphising that, but they just look like they're enjoying that flight, and it's so effortless. There's hardly a wing beat, and they spend an awful lot of time doing that. We've noticed very often, especially young kites, we often find them over small hillsides, not too steep ground, but they just use a little bit of a lift, and very often they come down and you can actually see them, they just barely touch the ground catching beetles and invertebrates, and they hardly land. And we have seen a number of instances where they're actually eating on the wing. I've certainly never seen them sleeping on the wing. And we do know that they go into to big roost sites, in particularly in Avoca. And that's where they do certainly sleep in trees. But very, very rarely would you see them on the ground. And if anything, when they do land on the ground, we'd often see them picking through for worms or insects as well. Occasionally they will land and walk around, and they just look incredibly clumsy. So there's just they lose all that grace the minute they land on the ground.
Now, there's an extraordinary contradiction here. This bird has done so well. I mean, thanks to yourself, of course, and to others like you. It has been an enormous success. It's back and it's thriving, which is odd that it should thrive in these circumstances when it perished so easily in its previous natural circumstance. Hard to know, hard to believe this bird didn't survive when it has that reproductive capacity in the past. Why was it rendered extinct so easily?
I think the big thing, and perhaps the thing that some of us underestimate, is perhaps the extent and the levels of killing that went on for many of these species. Many of the predators, there was a bounty on them. There was an incentive for people to get rid of them. We know Ireland went through extensive deforestation and the loss of that level of habitat. They were driven into pockets of suitable habitat, as many of these species were, things like eagles, even harriers indeed. We associate some of those birds with very high mountains, but those are the last areas of remnant habitat that they were able to hang on in. And I think it wouldn't have taken much with the scale of deforestation that we had across Ireland in losing that species pushing that species into small pockets. And I think that there's no incentives, fortunately, these days for killing these species.
They're quite the opposite.
If anything, it's the opposite. And they have been able. And I think the key thing, I'm very privileged to have been involved in this project. There's a huge team of people. But really the biggest thing, the biggest support and the biggest humbling side of it that I find is the support that we get from landowners, from farmers, from people that are just so pleased to have these birds as part of the landscape. We know they're eating magpies and crows and rats, and people are genuinely pleased to see them back in the environs and actually enjoy having them around, as well as being a joy to see. Absolutely.
Let me just flatter you for a moment. Fantastic job, because it is a wonderful experience. It's like going to Belfast and the Albert Bridge around this time of year also to watch the murmuration of starlings there. Now you can go to Avoca in County Wicklow or in other villages in Ireland and just see the red kites overhead. That's fantastic. Anyway, listen, you've got a very unusual backstory which got you interested in wildlife in the first place. Tell us a little bit about that.
I do indeed. And there's a gentleman sitting beside me who is entirely responsible for that. I've been fortunate to have a father that has had a fascination with wildlife throughout his life. And that is certainly where I've developed that from. I was privileged through the early adventures of my father and mother in going to Africa, that I grew up in South Africa, born in Rhodesia as it was then, and then to South Africa, and fascinating existence with a plethora of raptors and rhinos, elephants, lions, leopards, all through my childhood. And certainly I'm privileged to do a lot of stuff with my dad across Ireland, and we've been back to Africa a number of times as well, and he's certainly where I've derived my passion from and feel very privileged to have had that upbringing.
It's great to see you both in studio, because the first time I met you, your dad, should I say, Dougie, was when we were doing a shoot for a programme which you can watch on RT television on the 30th of December at 6:30 p.m. That's a Monday evening. So for your Christmas viewing over the Christmas period, 30th of December, it's called Back from the Brink, and it's a programme that tells stories of conservationists right across Europe who are doing what Mark and his team have done, bringing back wildlife, or at least stemming the extinction of species in various different parts of Europe. At any rate, that's where I met Dougie for the first time. Dougie, you must be very proud of Mark, are you? Because you sat there really patiently and quiet, and you listened to you were hanging on every word he said.
It's just a fantastic experience to share my twilight years of my working career, hopefully, sharing that with my son's passion, which we've talked about over the years, and I think derived from some of the adventures we had in Africa. So,
well, talk to me about Africa. When did you go there? Why did you go there?
Well,
where are you from originally?
Yes, well, I'm from Hollywood in County Down. Lived there until the Troubles kicked off, and In 1975, just after being married, my wife and I emigrated to South Africa, partially to get away from the troubles. And in those years, South Africa was deemed as the land of milk and honey. And like Australia, lots of people emigrated in those 60s and 70s. And mm-hmm. In a way, I combined my engineering career with what was a bit of a passion, wildlife and animals.
Oh, so. You and Richard, he did the same thing. He's an engineer too.
I didn't chase conflicts all over the world.
No, that was one thing. We'd only arrived there within 3 months and the Soweto riots kicked off. So it was a bit of out of the frying pan into the fire. But I didn't even learn from that, because we moved from Johannesburg up to Bulawayo in what was Rhodesia, Zimbabwe now. And again, was able to continue with my hobby of wildlife.
And what was your first big wildlife experience there?
We went to a game reserve called Matopus, where Cecil Rhodes, where the name Rhodesia comes from, was buried on what they call koppies there, which are small granite mounds. In that area, there was a game reserve, and at that time, it had a really healthy population of rhino, black and white. I remember having a picnic once on an outcrop of rock and climbed to the top of it, and just on the other side of the rock, there was a white rhino just below us. And so that was one of those spine-tingling moments that will always live with me. And I've had various others, but that was probably the first one, you know.
Well, we asked you in really today to talk about your latest great adventure. And to say that you're an amazing athlete and adventurer is a bit of an understatement. Now, in the past, I'm told you've participated in the Marathon du Sable. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly.
That's correct, yes.
Which is a 6-day, 251-kilometre ultramarathon through the Sahara Desert. You've climbed Kilimanjaro. And you've competed for Ireland in triathlons. Your latest challenge was the Four Rangers Ultra Marathon in Kenya. This is about more than running. It's about supporting the Rangers, who are the last line of defence between vicious armed poaching cartels and the elephants and rhinos you just mentioned there. They're battling to protect. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, I think I probably could have condensed that resume in just with one word, addiction, which I think my family would certainly reiterate, you know, and I continually get reminded of it. But yes, the latest, possibly the last long distance event was for Rangers, which in a way is gone full circle into that first instance that you just discussed.
What's the plight of the Rangers there?
With my past history, a lot of it's to do with African rhino, which have been decimated over the years due to poaching. And unfortunately, the only saving grace for them are the conservancies and the groups of enthusiasts and the bodies who have come together now at this late stage and are trying to preserve the global species of all rhino.
But you say the run is called again For Rangers.
For Rangers, yes.
So why For Rangers? What's happening to the Rangers?
Well, they are the boots on the ground. They are the people who are in the front line on what is a war on rhino. These animals are being slaughtered in tremendous numbers. Since 2006, over 9,000 African rhino have been slaughtered
for their horn.
Yes.
Because it's rubbish, because the horn is actually use to anybody.
It's keratin, it's the same as your fingernail, so it's used in various forms for as a status symbol and also in medicine, in traditional medicines. So there's a demand for it, and unfortunately, with that demand, the price of it has gone up and it's now more valuable than gold per kilogram. So it's a target now for organised crime. And the only people who are helping on the ground are the Rangers.
And their lives have been threatened also.
Yeah, well, in the last year, there are over 150 Rangers have died in Africa alone, protecting wildlife from poachers and in some cases from being killed by the very animals that they're trying to protect. Because let's face it, there's an element of risk that if you're in the wrong place at the wrong time, then you know, you're going to come out second best.
So how can a marathon like you took part in this ultra event help Rangers?
No, wait a moment. Let's ask him how far did you run?
Well, I was going to get into that. Hang on a second. How does it help them?
It was very good.
It was 230 kilometres over 5 days. So it was basically a marathon plus per day over 5 days through six wildlife conservancies. This was over 5 days and it was self-sufficient. So everything, your food, your bedding, your clothing, you had to carry on your back and run with that. They provided water for you along the route.
Dare I mention your age?
You may, yeah.
You mention it. Avoid me mentioning it.
I'm 67 at present, so it's...
Must have taken some toll. But back to the question about how does this help the Rangers?
Well, a lot of the funding which goes are on the major items, whether it be drones or night vision goggles or weaponry and Land Rovers. It doesn't emphasise as much on the actual people who are, in many cases, ex-poachers and local people who look after the animals and who guard tourists. And so it's for life insurance, medical insurance, clothing, because in a lot of cases, these guys are going out into the bush in trainers and clothing that is inadequate for the conditions that they meet. So unfortunately, where there's maybe a death, a ranger is killed, there's now life insurance set up for the families. There's education programs in the villages because these people don't have the infrastructure that we would have, and it's very basic.
Richard,
do you have hope for them?
We have to have hope, you know. There's a tremendous amount of work being carried out. And some species are doing better than others.
But can they not attack the market? I mean, if nobody buys, if nobody wants the horn, then there's no market. Let the market collapse. I mean, other medicines over the years have been synthetically produced. I mean, I know that the actual efficacy of the horn is rubbish. But, I mean, presumably the people who receive it get powder, they get something. I mean, they're not actually receiving the horn. So could there not be some... That they get whatever they think they're getting, but they're getting it synthesized. It's still carried. And it's still all the thing, but it's not removed from a rhino.
I think
no work can be done on that. I mean, who's the market? I mean, who's buying this stuff?
Asia is the main market, both for traditional medicine where they use rhino horn.
What's it meant to fix?
Well, it's everything from a hangover to an aphrodisiac.
The doctor of signatures, that's the relevant thing. What does a rhino horn remind you of? So when you turn to the doctor of signatures, you would think, well, this must be good for that.
It has a phallic nature.
But they eat bits of tiger for that as well. And it's not to do, there's no phallic symbol on the tiger. It's just because he's a big, strong animal, very well. But you'd be better off with Viagra. I mean, can they not plug that instead?
Yeah, well, again,
that would actually work.
You're dealing with a sort of, in some cases, an uneducated population.
Well, they've a few, Bob, haven't they?
Well, in the main. But I think governments are working more in conjunction, and there's certainly a higher profile now, and there's more pressure being put on governments to come up with solutions.
Well, would you go back to live there?
Africa will always be in my blood. I mean, it's a cliche, but it does get under your skin, and there's a side to Africa which I've always loved and I always will love and will go back and forward. Whether or not I would live there, I'm not sure.
Okay, well, listen, it's great to see you. Thanks for coming in. Very much appreciated. And you too, Mark. And again, to remind people, if you want to see the Red Kite in this programme, Back from the Brink, you can tune into RT1 television on Monday, 30th of December at 6:30 p.m.